This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For the many shoppers who have wallets bursting at the seams with payment and loyalty cards, this scenario may sound familiar. You bring your items to the cash register and face the quick mental calculus of which card to use. Visa, MasterCard, debit card, the store issued credit card. Well, Apple proposes to solve all that with a swipe, provided you have an iPhone 6, that is. 2 weeks ago today, Apple unveiled its latest creation, Apple Pay, a mobile payment system that it claims will make purchasing easier and more secure. Some major retailers are not having it. But why? Joining me now to demystify Apple Pay is Rob Fleischman. He's Chief Technology Officer at Zerocal and Word of Mouth explainer of all things Wired. Rob Fleischman, great to have you back with us.
Hey, great to see you again, Virginia.
So first of all, what is Apple Pay?
Okay, Apple Pay is a mobile payment system and digital wallet. So it's two things. Mobile payment, meaning it's focused on making, you know, helping you buy things both online and at retail locations, you know, point of sale, where
right.
you'd normally hand over your credit card mm-hmm. or cash, you know, at the register. And the second part is it's a digital wallet. And a digital wallet, they've been around for a little while. There are a number of people that have them. But it's just like a real wallet. What's a wallet? It's a place where you store things that you can pay for other things with, like cash and credit cards. So it's a digital way to store your payment information and a way to conduct mobile payments.
So if I am at Starbucks ordering a coffee, what happens?
Sure. Well, you have to have your iPhone 6, your iPhone 6 Plus, or the upcoming Apple Watch, because those devices have inside of them a secure element, and you know, which stores some of the secure information. And they, more importantly, have an NFC chip, a near-field communication chip. And we talked about this a year ago when they were just starting to come out. But what that does is it allows the device to talk to another system, usually a point of sale system, that's a, you know, less than about 12 inches away. So what you do is you grab your iPhone, you'd bring it up to the point of sale device, you would touch or tap or get very close to the device, and then you would use your finger on the Touch ID sensor that scans your fingerprint to complete the transaction.
Okay.
And, you know, it would basically be the equivalent of scanning your credit card.
So obviously, Apple must be in partnership with some of the big credit card companies on this. Who's on board with this as far as credit card companies and retailers?
So Apple has spent a tremendous amount of time and money designing this, testing this for security. There were over 700 engineers involved, a lot of secrecy. There are great stories about working with J.P. Morgan in closed rooms and things like that. But you know, to answer your question, I mean, Amex, American Express, Visa, MasterCard are fully on board. They're ready to go. Some of the big banks like Bank of America, Chase, Citibank, Wells Fargo, tons of retailers, you know, a lot of the people that you'd normally see in the mall are there, you know, your Aeropostales, you know, those type of stores, all kinds of retailers in terms of clothing, folks that are going to be convenient places like Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks. Those guys are all getting in line to sign up. And you know, there are a few who have held back. There's been some news about that.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot about opposition.
Absolutely.
Who's in opposition and why, more importantly?
Well, the real, you know, there's been some pharmacies that have been against it. And the real opposition here, you know, it's quite interesting. One of the big benefits about Apple Pay is the security. Security is much better. And I can go into the technology reasons why. But one of the aspects of the security is that there isn't as much data in the transmission. So when Virginia Prescott walks up and goes to Dunkin' Donuts or goes to a retailer and scans her credit card, the retailer, that business gets, well, this is Virginia Prescott.
Mm-hmm.
We know what the time is. We know what credit card she spent. We know how much she spent, and we know what she bought. So we have all that information, and that's very valuable to retailers, obviously. But Apple Pay eliminates a tremendous amount of that.
How?
Well, the way the transactions work is that once you have Apple Pay set up, what's actually in your phone is an anonymous token. A token that has no value, a token that I can hand out to bad guys, a token that if it's stored at a place like Target that's had infiltration.
Data breaches.
Data breaches, absolutely. That list of tokens has absolutely no value because those tokens are combined with something from you, your signature.
Mm-hmm.
So we have something you have,
mm-hmm.
your phone.
Right.
Your phone has special unique tokens that are only good inside that phone. They're not good in my phone. So if I copy them, not going to help. Combined with the Touch ID, something you are, those two get combined together in combination with a retailer. And those two kind of come together as a one-time credit card, a credit card that's good for this one and only transaction. And then that's passed through the system.
And it goes right to the credit card
absolutely,
company.
Absolutely, right to the credit card company that actually has your credit card information and knows you're Virginia Prescott. But everyone else, all they see are these tokens, these random numbers that have no meaning and cannot be traced back to Virginia. So because all of this has no ability to be traced back to who you are or what credit card you have or what account you have, everybody along the transaction has no additional data.
So Walmart is not going to have your personal information. Target's not going to have your personal information. There's a sort of coalition of retailers that have started working on their own electronic payment systems, proprietary systems, and there's something called Currency. Current with a C. Now, what is this? These are supposed to be competitors for Apple
Absolutely.
Pay.
There are different competitors and different ways to approach this problem. The goals are really the same. It's, you know, let's provide more security to both the retailer and the individual. So both of these systems, they're, some of them are token-based or digital wallet-based. But the real difference is who owns the data, if there is any data to be owned, who gets paid, how much privacy is given to each part of the transaction. And there's slight differences. The big win here, though, is what does the customer have? And Apple would like you to have their phone.
Not only the Apple phone, but the most recent Apple phone.
Absolutely, Virginia. Very astute. But that is exactly what they want. They want you to have their most recent stuff. And that's the upside to Apple. Apple views it as if we can own the platform, then we're going to win. And the payment system, yes, they're going to make some money here and there. And yes, there's a huge benefit to consumers. But I believe Apple's real motivation is to get Apple everywhere. I mean, I can imagine a system. I mean, there's also kinds of rumors about Apple TV coming up. But if Apple Pay gets popular, which I believe it will, gets ubiquitous, which I believe it will, you're sitting at home watching television on your Apple TV or maybe on some other device or maybe just on your phone, and a commercial comes up and they're selling something. And you can just hit your Touch ID button and buy it. And buy it in a secure way without making a phone call, without going to a website, without doing anything. And that's quite compelling. That's a quite compelling offer.
Well, one of the things I find so interesting about this is it goes kind of contrary to all of the information that we've heard about how data is being collected on individuals and the purchases they make and these kind of profiles, these data profiles that are created about us. Is this reversing that process, and is that something that Apple is specifically trying to do?
Well, it's certainly a reverse here. This is going to make a lot of retailers and a lot of people that make money off of retail data very upset. There's a lot more to collecting data than just the actual transaction, right? I mean, when you're mousing around Amazon.com, you know, they know a lot about you before you actually submit your credit card and hit buy.
Right, all the things you look at.
Absolutely. And so Amazon, you know, as the vendor, will certainly know what you bought without getting that data from the transaction.
So Walmart, Target, Best Buy, CVS, these are all companies who are right now taking a stand and saying we're opposing Apple Pay.
Yeah, they're going to fold.
Is that what I was going to ask your prediction?
I absolutely think they're going to fold. You know, I'm very close to pounding the table here because as a technologist, I look at security. And what do we got today? We got the mag stripe on the back of your credit card. Virginia, I walk over, I take the credit card out of your wallet. In 15 minutes, I run up charges all over town and online. With Apple Pay, I just can't do it. I just can't do it. And I'm a great technologist, and it's incredibly hard. And that's why I like it. This is, I'll go on record, this is the most secure payment system I've ever seen.
All right. I believe you. But Apple also said it was your photographs that you put up on the cloud were secure. Now, ask Jennifer Lawrence what she thinks of that.
No, you're right. I mean, it goes back to the basic authentication. In computer science, authentication is about three things. It's about something you have, something you know, something you are, or combinations of the two. So your credit card, something you have. Your cloud, something you know. Your password, somebody guesses it. Somebody steals it, the authentication is gone. Great thing about Apple Pay, it's a combination. Something you have, your phone, but something you are, the scan of your Touch ID. Those two combine together to make the security much better. So I agree with you. The cloud is secure, but if somebody finds out the thing you know, that security's gone.
Are we going to start seeing we accept Apple Pay decals all over town?
I think within 6 months to a year, we're going to see that all over town.
Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at Zerocal, and he's also Chief Explainer of all things technological and digital for us here on Word of Mouth. Rob, always great to have you in.
Always great to be here, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Feeling embarrassed? embarrassed, uneasy, a little bit perplexed, don't have the right word to convey the complexity of how you're feeling? Why not try German? We'll find out why compound German words are uniquely outfitted for life's everyday pleasures, pains, and unnamed oddities. That's when Word of Mouth continues, after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is a perfect day for Herbstlaubtrittvergnügen. That's German for kicking through piles of autumn leaves, literally translated from autumn foliage strike fun. Or Geheimgangsverlockung, the conviction that all large houses must have secret passages. Ever thought there should be a German word for that? Well, there is, courtesy of Ben Schott, author of Schott's Miscellanies and annual almanacs that have sold millions and been translated into more than a dozen languages. Last fall, we spoke to Ben after he completed a kind of translation of his own, a compendium of compounds to describe the inexpressible. It's called Schadenfreude, German words for the human condition. When we spoke, I asked Ben Schott, is this where English fails us, that we don't have a word to describe instinctively curling up your toes in mortification at someone else's embarrassment? That, by the way, is number 107 in Ben Schott's book. It's called Fußfaust.
It's interesting. English seems to turn to German in moments when we're perplexed, embarrassed, or unable to describe certain emotions. So everything from the commonplace angst to the more unusual Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude is experiencing pleasure at other people's misfortune. Now, there's no word in English, but Schadenfreude seems to be the perfect German word. So English has borrowed these German loan words for these strange emotions and sensations.
So these compounds can often be of many syllables. Can you pronounce all of them?
I can pronounce, yes, most of them. There's 120 words in the book. There's two or three that I find very difficult. But I'm proud to say I can pronounce the longest, which is Karfesteugs Innenaufstattungs Neugeruchsgenuss, which, as I'm sure your listeners will know, is the German for new car smell.
Well, you have references for all of these words in the entries. Now, why describe this, which I do believe is a particular flavor of air freshener? You can get new car smell air freshener, I think.
The new car smell was something of a joke. I like the idea of creating an incredibly long compound word for something that was very easy to say. But some of them are German words to describe things that really aren't easy to say. So we have, you know, a whole series. You mentioned one before, which is Herbstlaubtrittvergnügen, the joy of kicking through autumn leaves. But it's also, in a stepping way, there's Leertretung. Leertretung, which is literally void stepping, is when you step down heavily on a stair that isn't there in the dark, and you feel totally like your world's been turned upside down, like gravity's been switched off, and you feel very stupid. That sensation is Leertretung.
Let's hear some of these words pronounced by someone who isn't me from the Op Art podcast on New York Times opinion pages, where you are a frequent guest. Some of the words from Schadenfreude being pronounced by Dr. Oscar Bantlau. I guess it was a collaborator of yours, yes?
Absolutely.
Let's hear a few.
Mundphantom. Feeling that the thermometer is still under your tongue after it's been removed.
Seegarnik Frustration.
The gnawing sense of incompleteness, knowing there is a partially eaten snack lying around.
Dornhöschenschlaf.
Feigning sleep to avoid unwanted sexual intimacy.
I have to say, they are so fun to listen to and so fun to try and say, even if I'm getting it absolutely wrong.
Well, there are some that are incredibly just inherently pleasing. One of them, I wanted to create a word for that feeling, that instinctive knowledge of the thing that gave you food poisoning. You know, you're there, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you go, it was the salmon mousse. It was the oysters. And so we came up with Bauchgefühl, Bauchgefühl, which is literally gut feeling, gut feeling.
Give us a little background on that, though. You know, how do you determine need for these kind of words? You have a little note here that the travel site TripAdvisor has more than 26,000 reviews mentioning food poisoning, many of which illustrate that people know exactly what made them sick.
Well, the idea of creating these words started with finding a void for a word. So it literally happened on a car journey in 2008 when I was with my wife. And I said, you know, isn't it bizarre that the journey on the way back always seems so much shorter than the journey on the way there? And I said, there should be a German word for that. I bet there's a German word for that. And I emailed my friend Oscar, who helped me with the book. He's a professional Bavarian, so he knows what he's talking about. And he said, well, there isn't, but I could construct one. So he constructed this absurd polysyllabic word. And that idea stuck with me, because German is a language that you can create these compounds, and it does all the time, everything from doppelganger to, I don't know, a rucksack, for example. And so what I wanted to do was create new compounds for words which didn't exist, but sensations that we really felt as part of the human condition.
So what did you do? Keep track of words that you wanted something, some way to describe the ineffable, and came up with them?
Absolutely. I kept track of, I have a list of several hundred words that I thought needed to exist. And some of them are absurd, and some of them are more serious. For example, Unsterblichkeit, Todd. Sums up the intimations of mortality when your last surviving parent dies. Oh. And anyone who's experienced this will know there's this tremendous sense that it's now your turn, that somehow, you know, the ceiling of your parents has been removed and it's just, you know, you and eternity. So Unsterblichkeitstod is a pretty dark German word for a pretty dark human experience. So they're not all frivolous, and some of them really plumb what I hope are the depths of, you know, everyday life.
Why do you think German is the language for this?
Well, I think it is technically possible, because you can create these compounds in a way that you can't in English without making puns, which are always sort of lighthearted. And partly, I think it's something to do with the sort of Middle European past. So I think it's the fact that, you know, Freud wrote in German, you have Freud and Jung, you have the birth of psychoanalysis, you also have writers and thinkers like Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. There's something about that culture that seems sort of elegantly introspective, unlike maybe Italian, which may sound more poetic, or English, which I think is funnier and more glib. German has a depth and a seriousness that is useful to describe serious things and quite amusing when it's describing frivolous things.
Tell me again the word for instinctively knowing what gave you food poisoning.
Bauchgefühl, Bauchgefühl.
Now, I want to note that you said it was the salmon mousse. The exact same culprit as in The Meaning of Life, Monty Python's Meaning of Life. Okay, so where are you getting these sources from? I see in the press notes it says Justin Bieber, Groucho Marx. Where does Justin Bieber come into this?
Well, actually, seeing you ask, and I'm not sure you want to have this on your radio show, there is a word which is fishnedling, which is bestowing nicknames on your sexual parts or the sexual parts of another, which some lovers, I am told, do. And I have two references to this, because every word has references, times in the past, historically, philosophically, where writers have described these things. So this, the bestowing nicknames on your genitals, there are two sources. One is from D.H. Lawrence, Sons and Lovers, which is a very serious highbrow, and the other is Justin Bieber, whose fans nicknamed his manhood Jerry. So it depends whether you want highbrow or lowbrow, but if you're doing it to your bits or the bits of your lover, then there is a serious cultural reference that you can touch upon.
Okay, well, so we do, I think, frequently use doppelganger or Gesundheit, certainly, Zeitgeist, but do you really expect people are going to pick these up and start using Einzi July? That's the melancholy of cooking for one.
The lonely kettle, yes. The answer is I don't know. I think some of them are catchy and short enough that might get picked up. I mean, for example, Leertreitung or Betrug, which I mentioned, possibly. Some of them are just joyful and absurd. But this book, Schadenfreude, is also bizarrely coming out in Germany, in German. So there's a German edition. This is completely and utterly glorious. Knaus, the German publishers, have bought the German rights and they translated it back into German. So this book now exists in Germany, and I'm told there are people who aren't quite certain how much these words have been made up and how much they're real. So I'm hoping an elaborate confusion arouses and these words just sort of enter into the ether, into the zeitgeist even.
Well, Benchart, you design all of your own books, right? And which are more sort of objects than books. So how do you expect this to be used? I mean, coffee table passed around as gifts? What?
Well, frankly, as long as they're read, I don't really mind how they're used. It's a long, thin hardback. It's a strange shape because some of the words are very long and Germanic. And as you sort of hinted, there are the German words, mm-hmm. but then on the left-hand page, there are these very, very detailed footnotes. So I try and really go back and really explore the fact. Say, for example, the word Kissenkühler Labsal, which is one of my favorites. It is literally cool pillow refreshment, and it describes the joy, the ineffable joy of turning a cold pillow in the middle of the night and resting your head on it, that wonderful sense of chill and relief. Now, this has been described by some remarkable writers, including Goethe and Proust. So this sensation that you might have tonight goes back, has been described for hundreds of years by amazing writers. And it's that sense that nothing we experience is new. All of these sensations are something old and traditional and have a past and now have a German word.
Ben Schott, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And Word of Mouth continues after a short break with the curious tale of a 19th century patent for dentures, a dentist, and a murder. Stick around for that story if you dare.
Tief im Wald steht eine Schmiede und schon früh am Morgen schallt aus ihr das hohe Lied vom Amboss und vom Hammer durch den Wald. Schon von ferne hört man's klingen und die Vögel in den Zweigen singen.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Dentures, false teeth, whatever you call them, they're pretty much everywhere nowadays. You can buy them at the dentist's office or purchase them online or even buy gag ones at the costume shop. But back in the 19th century, false teeth were a high-ticket item. Our next story investigates how a patent violator and a murder may have led to their current low, low price. This story comes to us from Roman Mars and the podcast 99% Invisible.
As horrible and litigious as patent enforcement and infringement are today, it rarely results in murder.
Murder, sir?
But things were different in 1879. That's when a hounded and pursued patent violator struck back and made it possible for average working people to afford quality dentures.
It's a very historically significant murder. I mean, anyone who ever gets dentures is indirectly affected by this crime.
That's John Marr.
My name's John Marr. I'm the editor and publisher of the fanzine Murder Can Be Fun.
Before the 1850s, dentures were made out of very hard, very painful, and very expensive material, like gold or ivory. They were a luxury item. But the invention of vulcanite hard rubber changed everything. It was moldable, it could be precisely fitted, and it was relatively cheap. Everyone began making dentures with vulcanite.
And these dentures had been overwhelmingly popular.
But then in 1864, a long-disputed patent application, originally filed a dozen years earlier in 1852, was awarded and then acquired by the Goodyear Dental Vulcanite Company. It was a company created to collect fees or, very often, sue dentists who already used vulcanite. And there were plenty of dentists to go after. And the person that went after them was named Josiah Bacon, the treasurer of the Goodyear Dental Vulcanite Company.
And the Vulcanite Company was trying to collect, and Josiah Bacon was trying to personally collect, royalties from their patent from the dentists.
The Goodyear Vulcanite Company now monopolized the market. Dentists were required to buy their rubber and other contraptions used to make denture bases from them, and there were heavy taxes and fees associated with all of this. The price just kept going up and up.
Josiah Bacon was crisscrossing the country, throwing dentists in jail, extracting fees, fines, setting up sting operations. He is a very busy man, very enthusiastic about enforcing his patent.
It was reported and disputed that Bacon's zeal for enforcing the patent may have been more his personal mission than that of the Goodyear Vulcanite Company.
He had rigged the deal, so he actually personally got the money. I don't know how much the details, but it sounds like a very unusual financial arrangement with the company.
Enter Samuel Chalfant, a dentist who made dentures and who didn't pay the Goodyear Vulcanite Company for the privilege.
And Josiah Bacon was out to make an example of him. Josiah Bacon had chased Chalfant out of Delaware, out of St. Louis, and finally in San Francisco. And he was swearing he was going to send him to prison.
Samuel Chalfant was completely beaten down by this relentless pursuit and claimed that he went to Josiah Bacon's San Francisco hotel room on Easter Sunday, 1879, to make peace, to pay whatever he could, and just go back to being a simple dentist.
However, Chalfant, he had a gun in his pocket. And as he says, he argued with Bacon. Bacon threatened to send him to prison. To command some respect, Chalfant pulled the gun, and as guns that you wave in front of your enemies always do, it went off.
Samuel Chalfant murdered Josiah Bacon.
Chalfant was like extremely upset. He sat in the hotel suite waiting for people to come in to capture him. Everyone was down at breakfast, so he slipped out of the hotel and he wandered around the city and took a room in a cheap rooming house and just kind of laid in bed for a couple days, you know, guilty, feverish, distraught. And then he turned himself into the police. He made a statement to the police where he said that he had shot Bacon accidentally.
And the police believed he was sincere, thinking that he'd have to come up with some story better than that if it was truly premeditated.
However, when it came time for a trial, the prosecution had this man marching in the hotel room of his bitterest enemy with a loaded gun in his pocket.
The consensus was he was very lucky to get off with a 10-year sentence for second-degree murder.
He actually had a very good gig in prison. He was the prison dentist. He had an office outside the walls. Or actually, most importantly, he didn't have to work in the jute mill making burlap sacks like most of the other poor guys did. The only part of the prison uniform he had to wear were striped trousers. His patients who weren't convicts, he could collect fees from. For being in San Quentin, he had it pretty good, but nonetheless, he just found it enormously oppressive and, you know, was quoted as saying that he would almost have preferred to have gone to the gallows than to just be locked up in a cell for 15 hours out of 24.
Chalfant had a female admirer on the outside, fighting for his release by normal legal means. But it was alleged that she also tried to get him out of prison through less than legal means.
Someone slipped him some, you know, non-striped trousers, a railroad ticket, some money and some pistols, a bag of laundry, and he snuck out with a crowd of visitors taking the boat back to the city. And before they noticed he was gone, he was safely ensconced on a Utah-bound train. The only reason he was caught, he had disguised himself with some whiskers, but he was eating a peach while they were crossing Nevada, and the juice from the peach loosened the gum holding his whiskers enough that a rail detective spotted that this guy looked kind of suspicious.
He was detained in Nevada.
He never made it past Winnemucca.
Even though he got caught escaping, he was later pardoned and only spent 6 years in prison when he got out.
He returned to San Francisco and was a very successful dentist until he retired shortly before the earthquake.
But it must have felt kind of weird making vulcanite dentures.
In doing my research, I found a directory of professional men of San Francisco from the 1890s. And there was a half page in there on him, and it talks about his education, his experience in serving the Civil War. But it makes absolutely no mention of rubber dentures, Josiah Bacon, or the Vulcanite Company.
But this extreme case of anti-patent troll vigilantism, or cold-blooded murder, however you want to view it, did have an effect. The Goodyear Vulcanite Company stopped enforcing their patent.
Apparently, none of their employees was really willing to take a chance of being shot by a dentist. And there's also the implication that sort of this whole denture patent was kind of a Josiah Bacon's personal project more than it was major policy of the companies.
And the patent lapsed. Most of the world forgot about Samuel Chalfant, but the late 19th century dental profession learned from their bitter experience in what they considered the vulcanite rubber patent reign of terror. They collectively positioned themselves so that they could no longer be milked by any profiteering patent holders. Many years later, a similar scheme was put into motion to try to collect royalties for gold crowns, and the Dental Association killed it easily, without firing a single shot. "99% Invisible" was produced this week by me, Roman Mars. It was based off a story by John Marr from his fanzine, Murder Can Be Fun. The great, great, life-changing fanzine, Murder Can Be Fun. It's not a website. It's on paper. Ask your parents. Special thanks to plastics historian Julie Robinson. Yes, there is such thing as a plastics historian, and her name is Julie Robinson.
And Word of Mouth continues with National Books Critics Circle Award winner Nicholson Baker. He'll talk with us about the second book in his Paul Chowder Chronicles, Traveling Sprinkler. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Not a lot happens to Paul Chowder. Well, not in the traditional narrative sense, anyway. There's plenty going on inside of his head. He is obsessed with predator drones, the origins of the CIA, tobacco in its many forms, and writing songs about mundane things like street sweepers, or this one, Balance Transfer.
I got a letter with a periodic rate. I want a balance transfer, due on a later day.
That's just one of the songs written by Paul Chowder in Traveling Sprinkler, which is in turn written by Nicholson Baker. We first met Chowder, the procrastinating poet, in Baker's novel The Anthologist. Since then, Baker wrote House of Holes, a very funny and extremely dirty book of raunch, as he calls it, about a fantasy sex resort. Nicholson Baker spoke to us last year for the release of Traveling Sprinkler. That novel, along with The Anthologist, is now out in a single paperback called Two Novels, The Paul Chowder Chronicles.
He was having trouble because he was a non-rhyming poet, and he was trying to make sense of this great thing, this confusing body of knowledge called poetry, and he actually, in a great burst, finished that book. And some years went by, and I wrote some other books and essays. And then I felt that I had to come back to him, that I liked his voice. I liked his hesitations and his imperfections. I don't know. I thought he had more to say. And it turns out that his anthology is selling not well, but okay. So he's got a little revenue stream. And it's now time for him to take the next step in life. And what is that step? What will he do? How can he be a contributor? How can he be a better person, and above all, how can he win this woman back he loves, who has this quality of loving kindness that he really wants in his life?
So he thinks about doing a lot of things to be a contributor. He does do things too. He drives his Kia to Planet Fitness to work out and to Quaker meetings, and he tends his neighbor's chicken. He also eats at the Friendly Toast and Dos Amigos and buys cigars at Federal Cigar, which kind of anchor us readers here in New Hampshire and Portsmouth. Thinks about Roz an awful lot and compares himself to a traveling sprinkler. Can you explain that last bit?
Yes. Well, a traveling sprinkler is not as much needed in Maine or where I grew up in Rochester, New York, as in other places. But it's a little tractor-like device. It's got toothed rear wheels, and you hook the hose up in the back, and the spraying part twirls around on the top. And the great thing about it is that it turns a gear that pulls the wheels forward, so it's like a little tortoise that chugs through your garden at a very slow speed. And the question then is, you know, where should it go? And the really miraculous thing, and it was sort of patented in its current form in 1941, is that it goes where you have prearranged the hose, so it follows its own history. It follows where the hose went. So you hook the front wheel over the hose, and then moves through whatever it is that you have to say as a novelist, your garden of thoughts and preoccupations. And then sometimes if you make too sharp a turn with the hose, the traveling sprinkler can go AWOL and get off the hose.
That's what Paul says. He says, I feel like a traveling sprinkler that's gotten off its hose. I don't know where I'm going. I'm unprepared.
Right. And maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe the way to think about life is not to be overly prepared. Maybe it's better to take what the day brings, and maybe it's good if you're a novelist to capture the fact that days are filled with all sorts of very different kinds of things. One moment you're maybe making an egg salad sandwich, the next moment you're reading something unhappy in the news. Then in Paul Chowder's case, and in fact in my own case, maybe you hear a loud noise and part of the barn floor has collapsed, and that's, you know, something that happens, and you deal with it. what taught me about unpreparedness was going to Quaker meeting, because you're not supposed to think up what you're going to say in advance. If you're going to say something, you're supposed to wait and see what comes to you when you're sitting in this kind of amazing consensual silence.
Thank goodness for the Quaker meetings, because there is a little bit of rest we feel for Paul's mind. He's turning 55. He decides to play the guitar, which I love this. His friend Tim says is the middle-aged thing to do.
And he's, well, yes.
So Paul starts writing songs, and you did write and produce and perform these songs by Paul. Oh, okay, so is this a kind of middle-aged reversion for you, Nicholson Baker?
Sure. I went to a sort of a strange public high school and played the bassoon nonstop and wanted to be a classical composer. And then my first year of college was at the Eastman School of Music, and I was a bassoonist there and a would-be composer and practiced hard. And I actually got a job as a bassoonist, a fourth bassoonist in the Rochester Philharmonic. I had a set of concert tails and a white bow tie, and I played those notes that nobody hears in big Mahler and Bruckner symphonies and things like that. But then I put all that behind me because I didn't really have enough talent to be a bassoonist or a classical composer. And so I ended up going into writing. And that whole period of my life, I don't know, I think I was sort of saving it up all these years. And I gave all that to Paul Chowder. And he says at one point, you know, I've never used the word bassoon in a poem. And yet it was this thing that was so important to me. You know, at some point you have to think, maybe that's worth trying to wind a novel around.
We're speaking with author Nicholson Baker about Traveling Sprinkler. It's a sequel to his 2011 novel called The Anthologist and features the same main character, one Paul Chowder. I'd love to hear you read a little bit from the book. This is a scene where Paul Chowder, he's sitting outside, letting his mind wander on the minutiae of life, as only Paul can do.
My role is to be here in the side yard when the moon is swimming in the deep end of the sky with the tree shapes near it. It's a full 12 feet deep under the night pool, and there's a moon ring down there, and I'm swimming down toward it, and I hear the high vacuumatious sound in my eardrums, and I feel the tautness pulling between my toes, and I'm thankful that all my thoughts are non-sexual and that I can sit here with my mouth open and my eyes slitted. There are only so many nights like this. The middle of summertime. And even though it's late, a cricket like a bartender with a rag in his hand is mopping the surfaces of sound. Just one. The rest of the crickets are silent. Their abdomens are sore and chafed, and they don't want to chirp anymore. They want to rest, as do I. Even this one that I'm listening to is getting drowsy. He goes, chirp, chirp, chirp. And then there's a long pause while he sits and lets things droop, wondering if anyone's listening. And then chirp, 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 chirp. And then another long pause. Birds by day, crickets by night, singing away.
That was author Nicholson Baker reading from his latest novel, Traveling Sprinkler. One other thing I learned about you in doing research, in addition to playing fourth bassoon in the Rochester Philharmonic, is that you were a stock analyst on Wall Street and a writer of technical manuals. And I wondered about the technical manuals. You do have such an eye for these little things and how they connect together. You know, we flow from Paul's shopping list to the size of celebrities' mouths to Debussy. I wonder what your process is for this. Do you write everything down?
I take a lot of notes, that's for sure. And I did, you're right that, well, my first book, The Mezzanine, was partly written as I was commuting back and forth between this technical writing job in Mansfield, Massachusetts. And I would spend the drive down sipping coffee and dictating into a little micro cassette recorder and then transcribing it. And out of some of those spoken dictations came some of the passages in my first book. But I think that what happened actually was that I wrote a fairly detailed account of getting dressed in the morning that it came out in the New Yorker. And there was sort of a description of pushing the button through the starch-fused buttonhole and things like that. And I think that the detail of that description was what got me the technical writing job.
Really?
And so it helped me a lot. So I worked for a year as a technical writer, but yes, I don't know that I think any harder about anything than any other person. I don't feel that there's a lot going on in my head or anything abnormal, really. It's just that when something hits me, I think, well, that hasn't been looked at. And the way to look at something is to put it in a paragraph, do your best to surround it with the proper number of adjectives, maybe, and semicolons or whatever you're using. Actually, I've given up on semicolons.
Well, I wonder, how do you know how many adjectives and semicolons? If you do this process of, what is it, you call it speak typing, you know, you were talking about, you know, like just talking into a tape recorder now, maybe just typing. Yeah. How do you filter out all of the excess? And when did you stop with the semicolons?
The semicolons, I stopped for these two books, for The Anthologist and Traveling Sprinkler, because they're both very spoken books. I mean, he's sort of a fantasy podcaster. He wishes he were on public radio, but he's too shy to be on public radio kind of guy. What happens is it's a very difficult decision, actually. Sometimes there are many temptations to keep going in a certain direction and keep describing something, and you realize that you are trying the poor reader's patience and that you need to move on to something else.
Well, let's see if one of the other fictional, obsessions of Paul connects to you at all. He frequently pretends that he is a host of a public radio show. His girlfriend is ex-girlfriend, but, you know, there are still some flames there. Roz, she produces a radio show called Medicine Ball at the very expensive and hush studios of public radio in Concord, New Hampshire. So Nicholson Baker, do you have a radio wish voice like the Exploring the Music wish or voice out there somewhere?
Oh, yes. I'm fascinated by voices. I like, and the way to hear people thinking, the best way is to have just the voice. Mm. I like the imperfections, the indecisions, the moments where a sentence changes course when someone's speaking. So radio is fascinating to me, and I have a fantasy of being somebody who has a radio show or a podcast or something like that. When it comes right down to it, I don't seem to have the follow-through. I mean, but that whole experience of imagining my character, Roz, grew out of my own happy experience on your show in the hushed corridors of that beautiful building in Concord. It's so quiet and everything, and everybody just is doing their thing, and I just thought, this is and the equipment, those beautiful microphones hanging there in front of people. So it's a fantasy of mine to be somehow involved with radio, but you do what you do. And the thing is, being a writer is a very strange life because you have, in some ways, you know, I travel around and all that, but in some ways it's a very limited kind of existence. I worked at lots of different jobs, menial jobs mostly, before I became a professional writer at about 30 years old, and I've been doing writing since. So what I've got is my own life, my happily married existence with two now grown children in South Berwick, Maine, and we have a barn and we have a yard. I mean, I'm not off in Borneo. I'm not doing crazy. I'm not seeding clouds from an airplane. So when something happens to me, like going on your radio show, that's momentous.
That was Nicholson Baker talking about his novel Traveling Sprinkler, a sequel to The Anthologist. Both are now out in a single paperback called Two Novels, The Paul Chowder Chronicles. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is plenty more to hear at wordofmouthradio.org, where you can sign up for the Word of Mouth podcast. It's also available on iTunes. Earlier in the show, we talked to Ben Schott about some of the complex German words used to describe precise feelings and situations, contractions we don't really have in English. How, for example, do you describe the extreme, cringy mortification we feel for someone who has done something terribly embarrassing?
nor do we have a word for the distinct relief that another Halloween is behind us, allowing 11 months of breathing room before the next costume construction or purchase for the kids. What can you come up with? Either the words themselves or situations that are badly in need of words to describe them. Try your ideas out on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us tomorrow at 2 for our Election Day program on winners and losers. That's tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.